Welcome to PM Lessons Learned, a podcast for project managers, helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Increase your PM knowledge, build business relationships, increase your effectiveness, increase your marketability, gain professional support. Join our group and take part in our conference calls. Details at pmlessonslearned.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another PMLessonsLearned.com conference call. Tonight is our PM Lessons Learned PMP Study Group conference call with host David Radkovich. He's a PMP. My name is Henry Will. I'm a PMP, and I'm the one that is the founder and leader of this group, PM Lessons Learned. We're really happy that you joined us. Today is June the 5th, 2008, and this will be podcast number 36. So welcome to everyone on the call. In a minute, I'll be handing things over to David Radkovich to run the call. I just wanted to mention before I move on that two things. One is you may be interested in some of the other calls that we have. If you go to our website, pmlessonslearned.com, look on the left-hand side and click on the link that says Schedule of Future Conference Calls, and you'll see the schedule there. We have two great calls coming up later this month on project management best practices. We also have next week a job shop call, a PM job shop call. I invite you to participate, and please join our Yahoo group so that you can get information about the calls. The other thing that I wanted to mention, too, is the value of the PMP study group past conference calls. A lot of people think that they need to call in and all they're going to get is what they hear on the call this evening. Well, that's partly true, but they can also, anybody can take a look on the left-hand side of our website under the links section. There's a link there that says Archive of Past Call Audio. There's MP3s and podcasts available there for you with notes of the conference calls, and many people have used that information to study for their PMP. You'll see that all of the past calls that we've had, and at this point I think David will probably be able to fill you in later, but I think he's covered just about, if not all, of the topics that are in the PMBOK. So all of those topics have been covered, and they're all available for free. The audio is there, and there's information about getting to the presentations for those calls as well, all located on our website, all available for free, because PMLessonsLearned.com is all volunteers, project managers helping project managers. The only other thing that I wanted to mention tonight is that we did have somebody contact us just today that's wondering about Rita Mulcahy's CDs that are the fast track to studying for the PMP exam. I used her book and I found it very useful. I don't know if there's anybody on the call or if anybody that would like to contact us and let us know if they had tried those CDs and whether they found them helpful or not. Does anybody on the call have any experience with those at all?
Yeah, this is Robert Perrine. I used Rita Mulcahy's Hot Topics flashcard CD. And what I would do is just while I was commuting, I'd play the CD. It gives you a question, and then it gives you about 10 seconds to answer the question. If you don't answer in that time, then it goes ahead and tells you the answer. And so it's a good way to reinforce vocabulary.
Yeah, that's great. That's good news. I'm glad to hear that. I haven't used that material either, but it's good to have somebody give us some feedback on that one. I know, you know, the material that I used was her book about studying for the exam, and I found it to be very helpful as well. I know that I've suggested it to other people on this call before. The exact material that this person was asking about is the PM Fast Track PMP exam simulation software that's available on the rmcproject.com website. I don't know if anybody's had any experience with that. Okay, well, if nobody has, then perhaps when people listen to the recording on the phone later, this is Our calls are always available by telephone later as recordings, or perhaps when we publish the MP3 and the podcast, maybe people will be able to give us some feedback on that. It is a $300, $299 item, so I suppose the person who's asking is probably wondering whether they should go ahead and purchase that. I know that just knowing Rita Mulcahy's materials, I would suggest it's probably very good. Okay, well, without delaying any further, I want to introduce David Radkovich. I was thinking tonight about how David had called in so many PM Lessons Learned calls, and he had started a local PMP study group. He went for his PMP exam last year and obtained his certification. Congratulations to him for that. But he continued on giving back to the PM community by continuing this call and continuing to run a local PMP study group. So he's got a lot invested in this group, and he's got a lot invested in project management. And for that, we're very thankful for the work that he's done to help people along with studying for the PMP exam. So, David, it's with a lot of thanks that I'd like to turn things over to you, and thank you for your volunteer time with this group and giving back so much to the PM community.
Well, thank you, Henry. The first thing I want to do is apologize. I do have a little bit of a cough. I think it's allergies with this crazy weather we've been having. So if you hear me cough a little bit, I do apologize. As Henry mentioned, I got my PMP certification last year, and I will say studying for the PMP test definitely helped me land the current job that I have. I was able to talk the same language as the person that did my initial interview. I actually interviewed with the hiring manager first, and by being able to talk the same language and refer to things like earned value on the same terms, it really helped me get my current position. So that's one reason why I feel so obligated to give back a little bit. So wanted to say that. As Henry mentioned, we have gone through all the 9 knowledge areas of the PMBOK. If you go to our Yahoo group, which you can get on through the PM Lessons Learned webpage, if you join the Yahoo group and you go under
I'm
materials for conference calls. I'm sorry?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, somebody's talking, but I can't hear what you're saying. Okay, I'll continue. If you go to the Yahoo group, you go to materials for conference calls, past conference calls, you'll find all our presentations there. So. Tonight, since we have gone over all those knowledge areas, and I found this excellent website the other day, I thought it would be a good idea to review this website. This website was put together by Robert Perrine, who's on the call tonight. And I think it's an excellent quick reference to study as you prepare for the PMP exam. So what I'd like to do is have everybody go to Robert's website, pull up that quick reference, and what I thought we'd do is we'd just go through it. I'll throw some tips and suggestions in the areas, and love to hear from everybody if they have questions or even comments or tips in these areas as well. Our most successful calls are calls that are interactive and where people do contribute. So that's what we really want here. I do ask that when you do want to speak, you just let me know that you want to speak so I can acknowledge you and give you the floor so that we're not over-talking each other. When you're not speaking, we do ask that you put your phone on mute using the *6 button so that we don't get any of the background noise. Okay, we do have Robert on the call tonight, so I want to open the floor up with him and let him tell us about how he came up with the idea for the quick reference and how he used it. Robert?
Yes. When I was studying for the PMP, there's a couple of different methods you can use for learning. You can go through the material for familiarization. You can go on to memorization. You try to put it to application by putting it into use. And then another technique is called synthesis, which is where you try to create something new out of the material. And I looked at it and decided that I needed something handy that would just give me all the information in a quick reference that I could use on my job, take with me. And so I just sat down and started going through a variety of books. Sorry, was there someone else with a question?
Well, thank you, Robert. Well, we're going to go through. I hope everybody's able to bring up the website. I know we do have one listener that won't be able to do that, but I think we'll be talking clear enough that that won't be too much of a problem. So I'm on Robert's website, which I had included the link in the email message that I sent out. It's kind of hard to read the link here. Is there anybody that doesn't have the link and the website up? Okay, with that, we'll get started. And one of the first things Robert references is the work breakdown structure. And I want to ask a couple questions here, and I hope we'll have some participation. The first question that I have here is, what's the lowest level of a work breakdown structure? Say that again.
Schedule activities.
Activities?
Yes.
Okay. Is there anybody else want to... One second. I think the best answer is the second one from the bottom, the work breakdown package. Normally, here we refer to just as a work package. And the work package is the lowest level of WBS. Each package can then be decomposed, and activities will come out of a work package. But the work package is really the lowest level of a WBS. Okay? And I'm looking at Robert's notes here, and I think he has some very, very good notes, and really recommend that you do it. I think the key word here is, you're going to decompose with the work breakdown structure. What should the work breakdown structure include? The work breakdown structure should include all the work that is required and only the work that is required to get the project done. So you're going to decompose it down to deliverables, perhaps, but only what's required to get the job done. You know, you don't want to put anything extra, but it needs to have all the work, all the scope of the project in the WBS. All right, and Robert gives a good example of WBS there. I think the other structure that you might want to consider looking at is the organizational breakdown structure, and that is how the organization is broken down. And that will come in a little while. I'll have another question regarding that. The next section there is the critical path method. And that's basically how you can design your network diagram. And can anybody tell me, when you do a forward path, what are you trying to find?
Sorry, I have a question.
Go ahead.
What kind of work breakdown structure is this? What kind of methodology? Is it a basic work breakdown structure, or is typical of what?
The example that Robert shown, I think, here is very typical of a very typical breakdown structure. And what you when you see the numbers there, the number one is the upper level or the top level of the work breakdown structure. 1.1 is level 2. 1.1.1 is level 3. And I don't know if he goes, yeah, he does go into level 4 there. So what he's shown there is an example that actually has four levels of a work breakdown structure. How many levels you have depends on the complexity of your project. And, keep in mind that you do have to, all the levels of WBS should feed the level above. So, in this example, 1.1.8-minute meetings, the two levels below that all should feed into that 1.8.
Okay. This is Robert. One example you can look at also for work breakdown structure is the PMBOK itself, the way it's organized. each section is sequentially numbered, and it's broken down in a hierarchical form as well.
And I think that's one of the key words there is hierarchy. So that's good, Robert. I think, you know, if I was, you know, I remember a key word there, I think hierarchy is a good word to remember.
This is Judy. I have a question.
Go ahead, Judy.
Would you use the same numbering system to use it as a chart of accounts to track the expenses and time spent?
That's right, Judy. That's one of the purposes of a WBS is to get your code of accounts, which Robert does have mentioned there. And sometimes that numbering scheme is the numbering scheme that would go directly into your accounting system.
Okay.
As an
good
example. So that's correct. Judy, if you could hit star 6 because we're picking up a lot of background from you.
Oh.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? All right. Well, now we're going to go on to the critical path method. And the question that I was asking before is, when you do a forward path, what are you trying to find? When you do a forward path, you're trying to find the early start and early finish dates. So in forward path, you start from left to right in your network diagram, and you're going to try to find the early start and early finish. You do that by starting out with whatever date that you're starting at. Robert uses a starting point of 0. I'm more comfortable doing like Project does and using a starting point of 1. I don't think it really matters. What you're going to do is you're going to take your starting day. You're going to add your duration, and that's going to be your early finish date. So your early start date is the beginning. And keep in mind here that we're not assigning dates to this at this time, so we're not actually scheduling here. We're just building our network diagram. So we're just saying day 1 or day 5. We're not saying a certain date. So we're not actually doing scheduling yet. We're just creating our network diagram.
Okay.
So to do the early, to come up with your early finish, you're going to take your starting point, add your duration. Now, the way I learned it is you take your starting point, you add your duration, you subtract 1, and that is your early finish date. The reason you subtract 1 is that sort of just like project, you start your start date is the beginning of a day, your end date is the end of the work day. So in other words, if you have a 3-day task, it starts on day 1, it finishes at the end of day 3. So your early start would be day 1, your early finish would be day 3. 1 plus 3 minus 1 to get that. And then to do your successors, you're going to take the early finish, add 1 and get your to get your early start of the successor. That's one area that I do disagree with the way Robert has his diagram there, because you know, the way I've learned it and the way I see it in project is that, you know, you end at the end of one day and you start at the start of the next day. And with the four paths, we're going to come up with our early starts and early finish dates. A backward path, we go from right to left, working backwards, and we're trying to find our late finish and late start dates. Okay? Robert does have a very important point there, and that is that when you're doing a forward path, if you have an area where a task has more than one successor pointing to it, or predecessor pointing to it, you're going to use the later of the dates that might be there. So if you have two tasks feeding it, you take the task that has the latest early finish date to calculate the early start of that task. When you're doing your backward pass, you're going to do just the opposite, and you're going to take the earliest date.
I think my name is Charles. I think I have a question. Looking at the network diagram, the critical path method, I'm kind of confused. I'm searching for the numbers. I know I could see task A, task B. Can you just take me through from task A with the forward pass and the backward pass? I need to understand what I'm looking at.
Okay. Like I said, I have a little bit of disagreement with Robert on this one. Robert, you can feel free to say your point of view when I finish. I think the one thing you need to make sure you look at is on the bottom right of that blue box, mm-hmm. you see the description of what the numbers are there in under the task. So the top left-hand corner is the duration. The middle number is early start, and the bottom number is the late start.
Okay.
So he's using that. And again, he's starting at day zero. I like to start at day one. And like I said, the way I would have done this is I would have started at day one. The duration is 3 days, so I would have took the early start plus three to get an early minus one to get an early finish of three. So four pass, we're going to get our early start and early finish. Then for the next task, I would take the three, which is the early finish, and I would add one to say that task B and C both start on day four. That's what I would have done. And then add those durations that he has there. And for task B, it's seven. So I would have taken four plus seven minus one to get my early finish date for the next task.
Yeah, this is Robert. I have a PowerPoint. It's actually converted into just JPEGs. But it's up on the website as well to go through a comparison of a couple of the different alternative methods.
Yes.
Yeah, I put this one in just because it seemed to be the simplest for doing the calculations by hand.
Yeah. I think you're okay after the task one, you know, starting with 0-1, that might be just a little bit of the confusion, you know. I do think the next task, though, should start with a plus one, because, like I said, one task would end at the end of one day, and the next task would begin at the beginning of the next day, where you're showing the same, the early start, early finish date being the early start date of the next task. So. But I remember when I took the test, I did not have to do a complete diagram. I think all I had was maybe questions on what are you looking for in a forward pass, or, you know, what are you looking for in a backwards pass? So,
yeah, it varies quite a bit. I teach some of the classes for the Orange County chapter of PMI, and we get some students get three or four questions with the critical path, and some students only get a couple of questions where it's just really the concept. It's not the actual diagrams. It's a little bit unpredictable.
I agree. Okay. Now, Robert, you talk about float here, but you really don't talk the difference between total float and free float. I like to, you know, just mention that. The example that that you have here, I think, is for total float. What's the late finish minus the early finish. And that's for total float. And total float is the amount of time a task can slip without affecting the finish or the end of the project. So total float is how much a task can slip without affecting the completion or end date of the project. Tasks that have zero total float are considered to be on the critical path, and normally your critical path would be the path that has zero float throughout it. So when you go through your network diagram, all the tasks that have zero float, when you follow that through, that should be your critical path. Your critical path is the path that's the earliest you can finish the project. So I said that right. It's the earliest, it's the longest path through the network, but indicates the earliest date that you can finish the project. Which sounds a little confusing, but it's what it's basically saying is the longest path through the network says that it's going to take you until July 14th to finish the project. That means July 14th is the earliest you could finish the project. All right? Free float is taking the difference between the early finish of one task and the, I'll just tell you the definition of free float is refers to how much a task can slip before it affects its successor. So free float is for a task, one task, and how it affects its successor. Total float is how a task affects the end date of the entire project. Robert has an example there of relationships. You should know those four relationships. By far, the most common is finish to start. I would say that's probably used 90% of the time. Robert gives one example there. I heard a great example the other day about doing dishes. In a finish to start relationship, when you're washing dishes and then your next task is to dry dishes. In a finish to start relationship, you'd have to finish washing all the dishes before you could start drying dishes. In a start-to-start relationship, you could start washing the dishes and then you could start drying the dishes. In a finish-to-finish relationship, once you finish, you cannot finish drying the dishes until you finish washing the dishes. So that's just another example of relationships. I don't have a really good example for a start-to-finish, and start-to-finish is hardly ever used. Okay? Anybody have any questions? The next thing we're talking about here is tracking, fast tracking. It's starting a dependent task before its predecessor. When would you use fast tracking?
When the project is behind the schedule, it's slipping.
That's right. What you're going to do is you're going to go through the project and you're going to try to evaluate, is there any task that can be worked in parallel? And so you may be starting a task before the predecessor is completed. Again, washing and drying dishes is a good example. Maybe you have two people, one washing, one drying. That would definitely get the complete job done much faster than one person washing all the dishes and drying all the dishes. So that's a good example. Lag is a way of actually putting in some fast tracking. It's delaying between a finish of one task and start of another one. A lead, as Robert says here, is a negative lag. So I'll just talk about lag as being positive or negative. Project lets you put it in that way as well. So you could do it either way using, positive lag or negative lag. So a good example of that is pouring cement. You pour cement, you can't start building on that slab until that cement dries. So you might put a lag in there before you start framing a house, saying that the cement has to dry for 3 days. Any questions there? Next, we got some examples of doing some estimating. We have the three-point average, which is taking an optimistic, a most likely, and a pessimistic, and dividing it by three to get your expected duration. There's a couple ways to do a weighted average. And what a weighted average is just doing is just putting more emphasis on the most likely scenario. So in this case, optimistic's four times the most likely plus the pessimistic divided by six. So since you have six numbers, you're dividing by six here. It's not the same six as you see down below with standard deviation. Standard deviation is a sigma using Six Sigma, and it's taking pessimistic minus optimistic, dividing by six. The reason you're dividing by six here, it's actually using three sigma, which is plus three minus three, which is a total of six, which is the most common deviation for people to use when trying to do averages. Three sigma is, I believe, 95% accurate, if I'm not mistaken, off the top of my head. Does anybody know the answer for that? And to compute the variance, your average variance, you would take your sigma and square root it there. Okay, we see some notes there about crashing. You find the critical path. You really, if you're going to crash a project, which is another way of catching the project up, you only want to crash nodes that are on the critical path because those are the ones that are going to be more likely. Now, I do have a caveat about the critical path myself is, you know, just because the critical path, the path that has zero slack or zero float, slack and float sometimes are used intermittently. Just because it has zero float doesn't mean it's the best path or the most risky path through a network. You could have a path that has some floating in it that's much more risky and much more likely to fail than your path with zero float. So just one caveat about, you know, critical path and scheduling like that. So you want to work from the highest benefit for cost when you're trying to crash. You really want to try to focus on one node at a time so that you see the effects that it's having. And, you know, when you do anything like crashing or changing your schedule, you always want to reevaluate the critical path to see if it changed. So your critical path can change as you go through a project. And you can have multiple critical paths as well. Any questions?
Yes, hi. This is Arash from Torrance. I have a quick question. What is the difference? When I was studying for my PMP, I couldn't understand what is the difference between fast tracking and crashing. My understanding is fast tracking is you do some activities in parallel, but how different that is with crashing, that you put more resources on it. Activity or I'm a little bit confused on that.
I think you just answered it, and I think that's a good way to look at it. When you're doing fast tracking, you're not necessarily applying more resources to it. You're just looking to see if there's a task that can be done in parallel.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really not adding maybe any cost or anything to the project. You're just looking to see, you know, maybe what task can be done in parallel. When you're crashing, you're probably going to assign more resources, you know, put two people watching and drying dishes instead of just one each. So I think that's the biggest difference between the two terms.
Two terms. Thank you.
So I think you knew the answer. Right? Any other questions?
So what's the disadvantage of using a fast tracking and the advantage of using crashing?
Again, I'll give the typical project management answer.
I mean, I know crashing increases cost, but
right.
If you do fast tracking, does it increase the risk or something?
It could. If you do more tasks at a time, it definitely can increase risk. Usually, depending on who's putting the schedule together, a lot of times people will, fast track by, to meet a deadline date. In the real world, the deadline date is usually set for us. We can't normally take a project and work it out and say, okay, it's going to finish on July 30th. We're told that it's going to finish on July 15th, and that's the date we have to meet, and that's when you would use fast tracking more at that point to meet that deadline date. You would use crashing more if you fell behind and you had to catch up.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody have... I'm doing a lot of talking. Anybody else have any comments on what I just said? Or any different point of view? Okay, well, we're going to move into some earned value quick reference. And Robert has most of the terms there. And the formulas there, which are, I think, all these formulas here, you must know. I'm going to ask a question, and I'm going to ask, what does a CPI of 0.8 tell us?
It means that we are overspent or underperforming on our project. It's behind
CPI of 0.8?
Okay. Yeah, CPI of 0.8. What does that tell us?
Over budget. It just says over budget. There is nothing about the project.
Yes, but the actual 0.8 actually is telling us that for every dollar we're spending, we're only achieving 80 cents worth of work. There's one way to look at that. So if we have a CPI of 0.8, we're only getting 80 cents worth of value for every dollar we spent. And that would tell us right there that that's not good. So a CPI of under 1 is unfavorable. A CPI of over 1 is favorable, because if we had a CPI of 1.2, that means for every dollar we're spending, we're actually getting $1.20 worth of value out of it. Okay?
Okay.
One of the other tips I'd like to give when you look at the formulas, either for CPI or a cost variance or schedule variance or SPI, keep in mind, that the earned value always comes first in the formula. So you have earned value divided by actual cost, or earned value minus actual cost, earned value minus planned value, or earned value divided by planned value to get those formulas. But the earned value comes before the other part of the formula. So if you're looking at cost, you're going to use AC. If you're looking at schedule, you're going to do planned value. One other question I have is budget at completion the same thing as BCWS?
Can you say that again, please?
Is budget at completion the same thing as BCWS, a budget of cost to work schedule?
Mm-hmm. VCWS, is that what you just said?
Yes, VCWS.
It's the same thing as planned value.
And why is it not the same thing?
No, it's the same thing as planned value. It's budget cost of work scheduled, I suppose.
Okay, or planned value. Okay, is budget at completion the same thing?
No.
I don't think so.
Why? The reason it's not the same thing is BCWS, or planned value. I work in the government a lot, and they're still using the old terms. So I have to remember not to use those old terms as much. Planned value is at a point in time. So keep that in mind. If you take the end, or if you're looking at the end of the project, your cumulative planned value, by cumulative, you add all your periods up, your cumulative planned value at the end of the project would equal your budget at completion, but only then. And that's another thing. Does everybody understand the difference between a current period and the cumulative numbers? You know, most projects that I see have reporting periods at the end of the month. So the end of the month would be your time now, and the period would be for that 1 month, would be your period values. So you can have all these values, cost variance, CPI, earned value, planned value. You can have all values for them just for the current period. But you can also have your cumulative numbers adding up, you know, up to this point in time from the beginning of the project to this point in time, and that would be your cumulative numbers. By default, I think for the test, and you should always consider that you're looking at your cumulative numbers, not your period numbers. But if there is a question on that, just, and it particularly, I'm sorry about this call, particularly mentions periods, just keep that in mind.
Do you have any kind of formula to memorize the whole bunch of formulas here? There's a lot of formulas to memorize. So do you have any kind of...
Well, like
I'm trying to use a quadratic equation, but it's not working out for me. So do you have any kind of, like, easy way out to memorize all these formulas?
Like I said, my only suggestion is keep in mind that you keep your earned value number in front, and if it's cost, you're using AC. If it's schedule, you're using PV. For the different other equations, such as EAC, ETC, or VAC, no, I don't think there's any easy. I don't know of any easy way to remember them.
Yeah, that's, I think that's my real question. Okay.
Well, while we're talking about that, let's jump down to the EAC equations, because there's a couple examples here. The funny thing about it in PMBOK, when we're talking about EAC, there's a couple, I think the PMBOK shows three ways of calculating your EAC. And the thing to remember there, it depends on the situation. There's one calculation that you're going to use just your independent estimate to complete. So your EAC is going to equal your actual cost plus your ETC, your estimate to complete. But that's a independent or a revised estimate to complete, where maybe we did a bottoms-up estimate to come up with the, you know, what the estimate's going to cost. So at that point, you take your actual cost and you add your ETC. So that's, I think, the first example that they give you in the PMBOK. The next example is the first example that we have here. And that example is showing us that we have a CPI, and we expect the CPI, whatever calls our CPI, and as I mentioned, The CPI is telling us how much value we're getting for the money we spent. But we expect whatever caused that CPI either be positive or negative, or over one or less than one, is going to go away, and we're going to be able to get back as scheduled. And then you have an example where you say, no, I don't think I'm going to be able to correct whatever's causing this negative trend. And so you use the next example when you don't think you're going to be able to correct the negative trend.
And then, David, the fourth one is just a simplification of the third one. It's a little easier to memorize.
Okay. So in on all these examples here, you could replace everything after the AC plus with the estimate to complete, because that's really what those formulas are calculating, your estimate to complete. So you're taking your actual cost as of now and adding what you think it's going to take to finish the project, either by using, like I said, just ETC, a new independent estimate, or using some of these calculations using CPI as an example, to say, okay, I have a trend that's going to continue, and therefore I'm going to use my CPI to evaluate what my... So let's take that bottom example where you have EAC equals our actual cost plus, then you have BAC, which is our budget at completion, minus my earned value. So what you're saying there is I'm taking my budget, I'm subtracting the work that I've accomplished to date, which is what earned value is. Again, we're taking the cumulative there. So taking my budget, I'm minus how much work that I actually accomplished, and I'm dividing that by CPI, which means that I expect that value of BAC minus the earned value, which is coming up, which is my work remaining, right? If I had a budget of $1 million and I've earned $600,000, I have $400,000 of work remaining. And I expect that my CPI trend is going to continue, so I'm dividing that number, 400,000, by my CPI, and that's going to give me my new estimate to complete. So AC plus my ETC is going to be my calculation there. Does it help when we go over just that one example like that? This is really important. I suspect this is worth one or two questions on the test, so let's make sure we understand that before we go on, because I'm not sure I did a good job of flowing through that. You want me to go through it one more time?
Yeah.
Anybody? Okay, one more time. Our estimate at completion equals basically our actual cost to date, cumulative actual cost, plus our estimate to complete. We're going to get our estimate to complete by taking our budget at completion, you know, what we estimated was going to take to complete the project, and we're going to subtract our earned value or the amount of work that we've accomplished so far. So it's budget at completion minus earned value, which is, if you wanted to replace that with remaining work, that would be some good words to put there. BAC minus EV is remaining work, or work remaining there. And we're dividing it by our CPI because we expect the trend of CPI, you know, whether it's positive or negative, whatever's trend that we're on, we're going to expect that trend to continue. There's nothing happening that's correcting that trend, so we think that trend's going to continue, so we divide it by CPI. So in a case of the example where I used what does 0.8 mean of CPI, if we had a budget at completion of $1 million, we minus the value of work we've done so far, which is $600,000, gives us remaining work of $400,000. We divide that by 0.8, and that's going to give us a number greater than $400,000, because that's what it's going to take to finish the project. So, and then we add our actual cost to that, and that's going to give us our new estimate at completion.
Okay, thank you.
All right, was that clear to everybody?
Yes.
Anybody else have any questions?
So, David.
Yes.
So, David, we do have this different formulas for the estimated completion. So, in the exam, do you expect in a particular format, or they're going to ask how can you arrive it in different forms, or they might define in each scenarios and try to arrive the best formulas?
Well, again, the best thing I think to remember is, you know, using Robert's example up there, when it says atypical or typical, is the best way to remember those. If you can remember those formulas there, your atypical and your typical, I think, are the two that you really have to remember. And, you know, one is basically taken, so again, I'm looking at the estimate at completion equations, and he's got four examples there. One that says re-estimated, which is the one that I first used, AC plus ETC. And again, you just re-estimated that by hand. You're taking your actual cost to date and adding what you expect it to take to finish. The second example is the atypical, means that you don't expect the variance to continue. So you've had, a problem. Your CPI may be 0.8, but you don't think that's going to continue. You think that you're going to be able to do the rest of the work, the remaining work, as scheduled. So in this case, you're just taking your AC, you're adding your remaining work, BAC minus EV, your remaining work, and that's what you're going to take. Again, if you're keep in mind, if your CPI is 0.8, that means you probably had higher costs for the work that you've done in the past, and so that value is going to be higher than your budget at completion. And the example below is the example for the typical. So I would remember those two right there, the atypical and the typical, and make sure you understand and can calculate those two. And I think that's how it would be phrased on the exam, is, you know, you expect performance to continue the way it is. In other words, it's a typical, you know, your performance in the future is going to be typical of what you've had in the past. You expect it to continue, and so that's the formula you would use. Or it may say you expect that you can correct the problems you've had in the past, and then you use the atypical one.
Thank you.
Okay. And there, you know, there's actually, you know, these are the basic ones, but most computer software programs that do earn value actually looks at all kinds of things. They'll have one using CPI plus SPI. They'll have an example of the 3-month moving average. They'll have 6-month average. The software program, and what they're trying to do here, you're trying to use a formula to basically maybe compare, let's say you're using a contractor, and he's coming back and saying, this is what he's saying that the EAC is. You would use these formulas maybe to verify or compare the estimate that he's given you to say, well, you know, if I look at the trends don't match the estimate that you're giving me, so why are you giving me this estimate? Mm-hmm. So that's a typical reason why you would do these different trends. Okay?
Hey, thank you.
Hope we didn't confuse people. I think this is a very important section here. We're going to move on. We're going to try to wrap this up in about 10 or 15 minutes. So I'm going to quickly go over some things here under quality. I think there's some good notes there. I'm going to go to the Pareto diagram. Does everybody understand what the Pareto diagram is showing us?
said that 80% of the problems is derived from the 20% of the causes.
That's correct. So, and what it's, you know, it's aligning the problems from left to right. So, case one has occurred 12 times, case two occurred 8 times, case three, 4 times, and maybe all the other ones only 1 time. So if you're going to work on a problem, the problems on the left side are the ones you want to work on the most. In the control chart, an out-of-control situation is going to occur if one of your control points are above or the upper limit or below the lower limit. So when they when a point goes out of the limits, that tells you your process is out of control. There's also the rule of 7, which says that should any of your, should 7 points in a row be above or below the average, but 7 points in a row be on one side of the average, that also indicates a problem, because your results should be more random than that. So if you're getting a consistent points above, you know, not out of limit, not above the limit, but just all above 7 in a row above the average, that would also indicate a problem. Okay? And I see there that he does have the Six Sigma deviations over there, which I said Three Sigma was 95, is actually 99.73%. Like I said, Robert's got a lot of awful good information in here. I definitely would study this HR quick reference chart, know the difference between a functional and a, you know, you have, you know, keep in mind that functional is on one side, the projectized is all the way on the other side, and the matrix is in between. A balance being right between the two of them. A weak is much closer to a functional, and a strong is much closer to a projectized. Okay? A responsibility assignment matrix. I like to think of the responsible assignment matrix as being the intersection of your WBS and your OBS, or organizational breakdown structure. So where those, if you put the WBS on one axis and the OBS on the other axis, where things join is where your responsibility assignment matrix is. In this case, the example he's giving you there is a RACI diagram, and a RACI diagram is a form of a responsibility assignment matrix, and what it's doing is it's telling you a little bit more information other than just who's responsible for a particular activity. It tells you how they're responsible for it. Are they accountable? Are they responsible? Are they contributing? Or do they just need to be informed? So it gives you a little bit more information about that. Know your types of power. Your conflict resolution techniques. Keep in mind that the number one form of conflict resolution, or the most recommended, is confronting. That to me sounds kind of non-intuitive, but when you think about it, you're going to confront, you're going to solve the problem, you should get a win-win out of confronting. So that's the number one conflict resolution technique. The worst one is withdrawal, where you just avoid or postpone I think the motivation theory there is a good way to remember that. Remember those, so study those. McGregor's X and Y theory, I think, is good. The hygiene theory, you know, theory, which basically says that the hygiene factors do not motivate people. Giving people a better desk better chairs, better office sit-in does not necessarily motivate him. However, taking things like that away could demotivate him or be dissatisfaction. So though you're not going to get a lot of motivation out of giving somebody a new chair, if they've got a really bad chair, that could give them some dissatisfaction. So McGregor, X and Y. X means people don't want to work. You know, they intuitively have to be forced. And theory Y managers think people, given the chance, people will excel at their jobs. So, again, that's just a way of knowing, you know, what type of managers you have. And sometimes that can be required to be, you know, different types. The expected monetary value, I do think this is one thing. I think the example in PMBOK is not very good. I haven't had a chance to really go through Robert's example here, but it's basically just trying to figure out, you know, given a couple different options, what's, you know, the best value of options. You know, do I want to build a new plant? Do I want to just upgrade my existing plant? So.
Sorry, can you repeat yourself? I didn't get that.
I said expected monetary value. I didn't have a chance to, you know, really go and look at this example Robert gave here, but I do know the example in PMBOK is not a very good example either. But just keep in mind that what expected monetary value, EMV, also known as just decision tree, is just trying to help you decide, you know, what option is better. Do I want to build a new plant? Do I want to upgrade my existing plant? I definitely would, on the risk strategies here, definitely understand what the those strategies are. Acceptance, avoidance, mitigation, and transfer. Understand that residual risks are risks that are left over. Maybe when you do some mitigation activities, you're still going to have some of the risk left over, and that would be residual risk. And secondary risks are side effects of following a risk mitigation. So you might correct one risk, but you might create a new risk by correcting that. So that's what secondary risk.
What kind of, if I may add, my name is Charles. What kind of risk would you classify a crisis project or something? What kind of risk? If there's a crisis,
you know,
you didn't expect.
I'll use the typical project management answer, which is it depends. It depends on a lot of factors. It depends on how much risk your company is willing to take. You know, do you work for a company that is willing to take risk, or do you work for a company that wants to play it safe all the time? The best way to figure that out, you know, is from management, to get direction from management. And then what you're going to have to do there is you're going to have to, you know, put all your risk into a matrix to say that, okay, you know, and usually that's done by putting it, you know, your probability down one side, your impact on one side, and then, you know, grading what the probability is and what the impact might be, and then maybe doing some, you know, typical way of doing it is ranking the risk by multiplying those two factors together and then deciding that any risk that's over a certain number is a high risk, and you don't want to accept those. You have to find some mitigation for that, or transfer, or you're not going to accept anything that's above a certain value. So you have to, you know, either transfer it or mitigate it. And then anything below a certain value may be acceptable. And things in between you have to decide on a case-by-case basis. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, I think what we're going to do tonight is I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording. Maybe what we'll do, we're not going to have a call next month because of the July 4th weekend. I think the Thursday, July 3rd, and I suspect most people want to make some arrangements for the weekend, so we're not going to have a call on July 3rd. So our next call after that will be the following month. And what we'll do is we might just pick up from here. If you guys like this format of what we did today, let us know, and so we can just pick it up from here, send us an email or something. So I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording at this time, and then I'll stay on the line, and you know everybody else is you know welcome to stay on the line, and we can ask some more questions or anything.
This has been a PM Lessons Learned podcast. Project Managers, helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Come join our group. Visit our website at pmlessonslearned.com. Till next time, keep on learning.